lot of people think I'm crazy. They think I should be driving a normal car.
A multicolored VW Beetle with junk all over it.
Art? Don't think you'd call it art, okay?
What would you call it?
Different.
I just wish I could find somebody I can relate to.
That was a clip from the film Wild Wheels, directed by our guest today. Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today I'm joined by an artist, author, and award-winning independent documentarian. He'll be appearing in Portland in November. His films include Wild Wheels, Driving the Dream, and Automorphosis. And he's the subject of the documentary film, Oh My God, It's Herod Blank. Herod Blank, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thank you.
So we just mentioned that you are an independent director of documentaries. A lot of filmmakers believe in the fly-on-the-wall style of documentaries. They like to pretend that they're detached observers of whatever's going on. That's not you, though. You believe in being participatory.
Yeah, I like to get at the motivation behind why they're doing what they're doing and try to ask questions that'll give those responses by being one of them. So I'm really one of the subjects as well. So a lot of the questions I'll ask, I would have asked myself. And because I have this rapport and they know that it's honest, I think I'm able to get a deeper response perhaps than other people would have. With regards to art cars, I mean, we're talking art cars and or Burning Man. You may not know, but I've been filming Burning Man for 31 years on 16 millimeter film. And my father, Les Blank, shot 15 years. And he shot B-roll on a Bell and Howell wind-up camera, the same camera he used to shoot the aerial footage on Burden of Dreams. So there's a lot of different themes that I explored, one of which was the relationship between voyeurism and exhibitionism. And you could argue that art cars are partially an exhibitionist behavior. So the art cars are definitely a big part of the filmmaking.
Yeah, you talk about art cars. One of the most popular subjects of documentary films, I'm talking for the past century or so, has been folk art, American folk art in particular. And what could be more American than the automobile? You know, anybody who's been out on the road long enough has seen an art car and maybe wondered about the people who create them. You are an art car builder and enthusiast. And so you've directed three films now about the art car community. Wild Wheels was the first, and then there was Driving the Dream and Automorphosis.
That's right. And actually, Driving the Dream was something I created to get funding from National Geographic to make the bigger movie Automorphosis. And there are differences between Driving the Dream and Automorphosis. The big difference is that in Driving the Dream, there's Gene Poole's grass bus that he built for the St. Louis Cardinals. Commemorative grass field something. Yeah, that's not an Automorphosis, but some stuff is repeated in Automorphosis, but not all.
Well, the grabber for these films, you know, the visuals, all these art cars are just amazing to look at. They're just these incredible works of engineering. But your films, they go much deeper into the people and the culture and the community that would put their love and their time and effort into making these unique pieces of folk art.
Yeah, I think it just really comes back to identity. I mean, this is an identity that one is creating, and you're putting yourself out there when you make an art car. You have to own up to your identity. You can't really hide away in an art car. You can't go to Safeway and be anonymous in an art car. You are the driver of that vehicle. So I find that a lot of these people that do art cars are pretty bold individuals. They pride themselves in their individuality and what they believe in, and they're willing to own up to it. This whole thing about being anonymous in this world, I don't understand. Like, that makes our world so boring. If everybody's the same and nobody's showing their true colors, what kind of a world is that? I was always surprised growing up that there weren't more art cars. I was always surprised that there weren't more people doing wild shit.
Yeah, well, you've personally made art cars that kind of stretch the limits of what a vehicle can handle. I mean, your camera van is a Dodge van with 2,000 cameras attached to it.
Yep.
And I was going to say it must weigh a ton, but then I think I'd be lowballing the estimate.
Yeah, you probably would be, and I probably would be too, because I'm not sure what the legality is of all this. But I did start out with a one-ton van, so I knew going into the project that I better start out with something beefy, and I'm glad I did, because, like, let's just say like a Honda Odyssey minivan, for example, if you covered that door, one of those doors, with cameras, the thing would fall off if you opened it. That's the difference. I mean, contemporary cars, a lot of them are plastic bumpers. And in that case, you know, the silicone would stick, but not with that much weight, perhaps. The camera van really needed something beefy. And I'm glad I did it it was a Pacific Bell telephone van, one ton. It was all white when I started. And that thing, it's done really well. It's been all over the world, you know, and it's still, the doors are still on it. You can still open and close.
You know, you mentioned people trying to be anonymous and all and go along with the crowd. And there's these culture wars going on right now all over the U.S., but mostly across the South. And they're really kind of isolating the oddballs. And yet you're going into places like Houston, Texas, and Douglas, Arizona, and you're bringing your art cars and all the amazing people, flamboyant people who are part of the scene to these places, and the communities are very welcoming.
Now wait just a minute, because when you bring art cars into a community for the first time, let's just take Houston, for example, in the early years, in the late 1980s, I can remember when I brought art cars to Houston, I was pulled over every year. I was interrogated by the police. They wanted to know what the hell I was doing. And when something is not defined and people don't understand it, their first response is, we're scared. You're not to be trusted. We're going to throw the book at you. You know, and so it's not really comfortable to have an art car in anywhere USA. Because it's still, even to this date, they haven't been defined as being a positive in that community. But do you realize that if you go to Houston now in an art car, you're almost a superhero, because they've been defined as culturally valuable. They've been defined as something to be celebrated. And the artist that drives it, like when they go to the supermarket, they're to be celebrated because they're doing something for the community. And there's an understanding. So that definition is what has been needed. And it's really what my life work has been, is defining this as an art form that's positive for the community, and that expressing yourself is positive. It's a good thing. It's a win-win for everyone. You know what the byproduct of suffering is? The byproduct of suffering when you make an art car and a person dumps their cathartic pain and love into this vehicle, the byproduct is love and positive, and it makes people happy. So you turn pain into love with the vehicle, and then you drive it around and you make everyone happy. To me, that's a positive thing. It's a healthy thing, I believe. But you have to define it as something positive in these communities before they get embraced. And Houston's a great example. Houston, the difference between Houston 1980s or even LA 1980s and contemporary LA and Houston now with regards to art cars is amazing. Totally different.
If I've got this right, your family's from New Orleans, and after Katrina, Houston sort of ended up with a lot of the New Orleans folks and a lot of the music scene that used to be native to New Orleans.
That's true. In fact, a lot of my cousins that were living in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, they got displaced and they ended up moving to Houston. And I do think that's true about the musicians as well. I think a lot of musicians move to Houston. So Houston, I think it's become different after Katrina. So is New Orleans. New Orleans is a lot different than it used to be. But my father's side of the family was from Tampa, Florida. My mother's side of the family was from New Orleans. So I have a Southern backdrop, but they fell in love, my mother and father, in Tulane. My father was in graduate school. My mother was an undergrad, and they moved to LA and they had two babies, my brother and I. And then my father, Les Blank, was becoming a filmmaker at that time. Oh, and then the funny part of this story is that my father was seeing other women. So my mother thought, well, I'm going to see other men. And she ended up seeing my father's sound guy, whose name was Skip Gerson. And my mother and Skip Gerson moved us from LA in 1977 to a commune in the Santa Cruz Mountains. So I grew up in a commune, and my role was to milk the goats. So I didn't have a television, didn't have any friends. It was just me in the forest. I mean, I'm generalizing, but it was me in the forest more than anything. And so I had a very strange upbringing. And then I had two parents that were artists. My mother was an erotic ceramicist and my father was a filmmaker. And so I had this pretty culturally diverse backdrop. And my education, by the way, in films was mostly documentaries and foreign films. So I had a strange, even my film background was, if you can imagine, was really the background of Les Blank and what Les Blank wanted to go see. That's what I went to see. It's a lot of Ingmar Bergman, a lot of Werner Herzog, a lot of Truffaut, and all, you know, all just different filmmakers from around the world.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. Let's play a clip from the Herod Blank film Automorphosis.
You know, frankly, it's difficult to go against the grain. Ever since we've been born, we've been conditioned with the imagery and the messages that we should live a certain way.
In the beginning, my mission was to get as much attention as possible.
Then, when I realized how much attention I was getting, that's when I started saying things on the car, things that I believed in.
I want people to realize I'm the man who did something that nobody else really can.
If you put yourself out on a limb a little bit and don't mind looking like the fool, then people are more receptive to what you have to say.
When I was in college, I became fascinated by other art car people. What was it that was motivating all of us to do this?
That was a clip from the film Automorphosis. You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Counser. And today we're talking with artist, author, and independent documentarian Herod Blank. Before we get back to the conversation, I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners that KBOO is in the midst of our Fresh Off the Vine membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our programming and that you'll take a moment to pledge your support. There are all kinds of ways to join KBOO. On the web, you can visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now let's talk some more with our guest, Herod Blank. Well, yeah, you mentioned you come by your artistic sensibilities, honestly. Your mom, Gail Perrin Blank, was a ceramic artist and teacher. Your dad, of course, celebrated documentary filmmaker Les Blank. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that one of the great archivists of American music was the ethnomusicologist Alan Lomax. His field recordings almost a century ago now preserved rural roots music that was dying out as the country became more urbanized. In some ways, I think of you and your dad as the modern film counterparts to Alan Lomax, you know, chronicling the folk art that is not of interest to the mainstream institutions, at least not yet.
I think that's fair to say in some ways. I mean, especially for my father, focusing on blues musicians and regional musicians that might not have otherwise gotten the attention and light on them. I mean, one of the films that I made recently was on Dugout Dick, who lived in Salmon, Idaho, in the riverbanks, and he was looking for gold. And he didn't find gold, so he turned these caves into residencies that he would rent for $5 a night. And I made that film during COVID because I thought if anybody in the world would get through COVID, it would be him, because he was a hermit. And so we ended up making this movie, and that's what you're talking about. It's sort of like I shed light on somebody that otherwise most likely would not have been featured in a short 20-minute film. And I feel really good about it because he lived a valuable life and he had a valuable lesson for people to know. And that is, living off the land, even if you're a hermit, it's a beautiful life. And it might not be the life that we want, but it's still a beautiful life. And it just makes you think, wow, there's so many different ways to live in this with the lives that we have. There's so many choices that we can make. I think that just makes you think about the life that you're living and whether there's anything that you would want to do differently in the way that you live your life. Being an archivist, I mean, really what I'm doing right now is I'm an archivist for Les Blank. I mean, I went to the dance, JTL Ball, which we're playing in Portland. We remastered it. And we remastered, in fact, all three of the films that were done by Chris Strockwitz and Les Blank. Chulas Fronteras, Del Mero Corazon, and now JTL Ball.
By the way, that's a 1989 chronicle of the music of French Southwest Louisiana, and the people in there, the musicians in there include Clifton Chenier and Michael Doucet and Beausoleil. It's just a great document of this scene and this community. I mean, people who are part of this whole longstanding culture down in the Gulf.
Yeah, and you know, the children of these people are now musicians and performing, and so it carries this tradition on. And I'm carrying on the tradition that Les was in. So this screening in Portland, I would say the most significant part about this is that it's combining the work of Les Blank with JTL Ball and the work of my own work, which is Automorphosis. And then a strange curveball that's being thrown at everybody, which is Killer Clowns from Outer Space, in which I played Seven of the Clowns back in mid-80s when I was in college in Santa Cruz. And now that film has become this bizarre cult classic that, I mean, five-year-olds are watching this movie now. And it came out in 1988.
That is a cult classic, Stephen Chiodo. Yeah, talk a little bit more about Killer Clowns from Outer Space. I mean, because that has to have some backstories in it.
Oh, there's so many tie-ins to all of these films. And by the way, this was Greg Hamilton's idea to program these three movies at the same time. Also during my father's birthday, which is November 27th. And I don't actually know which movies are playing where and when. So you'll tell people this at some point, right?
I got you on that.
Okay, cool. So the backstory of Killer Clowns is, Oh My God. Okay, so Oh My God is my first art car. And if you really want to do a psychoanalysis on why Oh My God was created and what does it signify, you could argue that Oh My God was a way for me to get my father's attention. Okay, I'm going out on a limb a little bit. So maybe that's what part of the reasoning was, right? So it's a reaction to my father, who is very quiet and stoic and not demonstrative of love and affection. So So I made a car to get its attention. And then I drove that car around Santa Cruz. It was my car at UC Santa Cruz, Santa Cruz High School before that. And I had just graduated from UC Santa Cruz. And I saw in the newspaper, the Santa Cruz Sentinel, that they were doing a casting call for extras for crowd scenes in Killer Clowns from Outer Space. So I go down there and, oh my God, and I pull up in the car and there's the Kyoto brothers with their clipboards and they're looking at people and getting stuff organized. And they see the art car and they notice that. And then I ended up standing next to them, and I played college basketball. So I'm 6'4" and I was in really good shape. You know, I was in prime of my athletic career, and I stood next to them or something. And they said, "Hey, you're really big. You're a specimen." And I said, "Well, thank you. I play college basketball." And they said, "You think you could play a clown?" And I said, "Sure, I could play a clown. Look at my car." And all that. That's what we're thinking. So they asked me to stay after to rehearse in costume that night. And so I put on a costume and they had me walk across the room. And I think they said, "Go choke that guy." So I went and choked him. And then they had me act like I was drunk, and I did all these things. And they said, "Hey, are you busy the next 2 weeks?" I said, "No, actually, I'm available." "Well, you want to work as playing clowns for 2 weeks?" I said, "Sure, done deal." And it turned out to be just an incredible serendipitous opportunity that, you know, I kind of fit in being the clown. They wanted clowns that were taller and bigger. And in fact, the guy that played Jumbo in the movie was played by, and I didn't know this at the time, by Steve Rockhold, who was a semi-pro basketball player who was like 6'11", if not 7 feet. And we used to play basketball together. So two of the leading clowns were basketball players that played pickup ball at UC Santa Cruz all the time. It was just a strange thing that you got these UC Santa Cruz basketball playing clowns. And then life goes on for 25 years. The movie had a release, but it wasn't that significant. It had a pretty good VHS release. And then 25 years later, I get this really weird random phone call. "Are you Harrod Blank?" And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, I want to be your agent." And I said, "For what?" And he said, "You were in Killer Clowns, weren't you?" And I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Well, we want you to sign autographs." I said, "Nobody in the world is going to want my autograph. That's a silly idea." And he goes, "I've already been asked for it." And I'm like, "Oh, shit, really? You've been asked for my autograph?" And he says, "Yeah." So he sent me to Orlando, and I made more money that first weekend signing autographs. And every year it's gotten more intense. So for 10 years, I've been doing these Killer Clowns autograph sessions at horror conventions. And it's a very weird reality. And it's actually getting more intense now, to the point where people are tattooing the face of my character on their body, like big, like a lot. Like every convention, people are coming up and showing me their tattoos. So I don't know what happened. I don't know why this happened, but it did. And so there's this strange career path that I was on. And Oh My God connects everything together. Oh My God connects Killer Clowns, my father, Automorphosis, and Burning Man. Oh My God is the centerpiece, is part of all these things. So really, it's Oh My God is the glue.
And Oh My God is the title of the David Silverberg film, Oh My God, It's Harrod Blank. What was it like being a documentarian, being the son of a celebrated documentarian? What was it like to be the subject of a documentary yourself?
It's actually pretty strange to have a documentary made about you. And it makes you think, well, am I really like that? Or is it really the perception of the filmmaker that I'm like that? You know, because when I watched the movie, I was like, man, I'm a lot funnier than that. I seem depressed in the movie in my mind. So it's just a strange thing. And then, of course, you realize that after my father died in 2013, the first thing on the list that he wanted me to do was to remaster and release the Leon Russell film. And so when I did that, Leon Russell was very uncomfortable with the movie made about him.
That was your dad's film, which was...
A Poem as a Naked Person. So Leon was super uncomfortable. And I told him, I said, listen, whatever hang up you have over the movie is water under the bridge. People love you so much that when they see this movie, they're just going to love you. I promise you. Even if you think it doesn't make you look good, they're going to love you because it's you in the 1970s when you were at the peak of your stardom. And he kind of listened to me. And then when we showed it at South by Southwest as the premiere in 2015, he was flabbergasted. He was blown away by just how much he got a standing ovation when the movie credits came up. I mean, this clapping ovation went on for like 10 minutes. And then we were off and running, showing the movie around the country. And it's just, Leon, we did a question and answer at the Film Forum in New York. And the host of the Q&A was Jonathan Demme. And Jonathan Demme asked Leon, so what was the reticence to not releasing this film over all those years? And Leon told him, well, it seemed like it was more about a movie about sunsets and snakes than it was about me. And Jonathan Demme said, well, how many times did you watch the movie back in the day? And he said, I only watched it once. And he goes, well, you know what they say? When you're the subject of a documentary, you need to watch a film three times. The first time, you're watching the film about how you look and how you sound and how you are in the picture. The second time you watch it, you're watching it as how you look, how you are in relation to other things going on in the movie. And then the third time you watch it, you can see it as a complete work, as a film. Then you can make a judgment call on whether it's a good movie or not. And Leon said, wow, that's really smart. He says, well, I like it better now. So I would say that, you know, that's for me, I never had a problem with David's movie. I just felt like it really wasn't how I would have portrayed myself, but I still like the film. And I really appreciate David for having spent 23 years of his life making it. I mean, he was filming me back in college. He was filming me at UC Santa Cruz, and David Silberberg, Paul Cope, and myself were three students in film school at UC Santa Cruz. And the three of us worked on each other's movies and did exchange of labor. So Paul Cope was cinematography, David Silberberg was doing audio, and I was doing cinematography or being a subject. And it really worked out. And we're still friends to this day, and we still work together to this day, which is amazing.
And back in the 80s, you were playing around with 16 millimeter Bolex H16s and NagraSync giant heavy quarter inch sound tape machines.
We actually, in college, we had Super 8 cameras in the film program. And we decided, well, wouldn't it be an interesting film if all three of us have a Super 8 camera? We all take mushrooms together, and then each of us films each of us tripping on mushrooms. So we started out by going to 7-Eleven. And we're all tripping. And I for some reason, I just wanted to experience the feeling of pouring milk in my ear. So David and Paul are filming me pouring milk in my ear, and it just went on from there. It was just a crazy, and then we look at the footage and we're like, that's stupid. What are we going to do with this?
Did it end up in David Silberberg's film?
No. You know what? Wait a minute. Did it?
So you haven't watched it three times.
I haven't watched it in a while. David is actually remastering the film right now. And I've been telling him, listen, David, why don't you throw in Killer Clowns into your movie? Because this is a part of my reality that people don't know about. And I think they find it interesting. And Les Blank actually filmed my first Killer Clowns appearance in Orlando. So I thought, well, if Les filmed it, it might as well be something that David contemplates. So we'll see what happens. But I'm trying to convince him to throw it in there.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. Let's play a clip from the Herod Blank film, Dugout Dick.
So, Dick, where are we?
We're up here, the western part of my claim, or mining claim. Western part of time here.
Can you tell me what you're looking for in here?
Oh, I'm looking for silver and copper, gold, whatever. Or just making a house. If it don't, like I always do, if I don't find enough ore, I make a house out of it. I already got beds in it. Got two beds in it. I got room for more.
That was a clip from the film Dugout Dick. You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And today we're talking with artist, author, and independent documentarian Herod Blank. His films include Wild Wheels, Driving the Dream, and Automorphosis. Before we get back to the conversation, I'd like to remind our listeners that KABU is one of the very last media outlets that still brings you local and independent news, music, and public affairs. We've been doing this here in Portland for over half a century, and this program has been coming to you for 20 years now, inviting important cultural figures into the studio and venturing out to events that might fly beneath the radar of the big media monoliths. So yes, you can support this very special programming today by going online to kboo.fm/give, or simply text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now let's talk some more with our guest, Herod Blank. Back in the 1960s and the 70s, I believe that your dad, Les Blank, got a lot of the funding for his films from government and foundation grants. By the time you started making films, it was the 1980s, and public art in the U.S. was on its way to being largely defunded. So you tried a novel approach for your first feature. This was decades before crowdfunding became popular. You went out and you sold shares in your film Wild Wheels to investors?
Yeah, now this is because my mother married an investment banker named Bert Keenan. And Bert Keenan was in love with my mom and wanted to date her when they were in high school in New Orleans. And she said no. And so then she did her life. And when she was 43 years old, and she had a bad experience in the commune, and her boys went off to college, my brother and I, she was left with not much. So she decided to go back to New Orleans and visit her parents. And she ended up meeting Bert Keenan at a party. And then he asked her out, and the rest is history. So all of a sudden, I went from having, I have my father figure of Les, always I have the same father figure, but then I have these stepfathers, and Bert Keenan became one of my stepfathers. And he knew that I had this dream to make this movie. And he said, well, why don't you make it like a Hollywood film and just sell shares in the movie? So he had a contract drawn up. And he said, but you're going to have to be the one that goes out and gets the shareholders. So he said, I said, well, where do I do that? And he says, you have to go and approach people that have enough money to invest, and they're going to invest in you. So you have to do a sales pitch and sell them on our cars and how great this movie's going to be. So I go around for the next year in New Orleans, in Mississippi, contacting wealthy doctors, lawyers, and such, and having meetings with them and trying to sell them shares in this documentary. And I actually did. I ended up raising some money. And then I also...
I understand at one point you were making the rounds of gambling boats on the Mississippi River. Where
did you hear this story?
You were pitching this investment to the guys at the slot machines?
No. Actually, what happened was I thought, well, where am I going to find these millionaires and wealthy people? And I thought, where do people, have money and they're willing to risk it? And I thought, gambling ships in Mississippi. So I ended up going out one night, and I brought my investment portfolio to the casino. And I noticed when I went to cash in some money for chips, the woman in front of me was wearing a blue denim matching jacket and pants with rhinestones. And I noticed out of the corner of my eye that she had tears coming out her face. So I tapped her on the shoulder and I said, you look really upset. Are you okay? And she goes, I just lost $5,000 on this in this casino. And I said, $5,000? I said, you'd be better off investing in me. And she goes, what do you do? And I said, I'm making a documentary on art cars, you know, crazy cars that are decorated, blah, blah, blah. And she goes, oh, really? Dries her tears. But tell me more. And then we get a drink and it goes on from there. And of course, I didn't raise any money. She just wanted to sleep with me. But the things I had to do to try to raise money were insane. But I ended up also simultaneously playing the credit card game. And I learned how to play it very well, all self-taught. And I managed to raise $65,000 and go in debt on my credit cards, move the credit card balance from one to the other for those stupid 0% balance transfers. Boy, they hated me. I didn't pay any interest on $65,000. I had to pay a cash advance, you know, a little bit of a like $300 fee for the cash advance. But basically, I ended up borrowing $65,000 for, I think it was 6 to 8 years with no interest. And then Wild Wheels played all over the world on TV. And I took that TV money, paid back my credit cards, and then started paying the investors. And by this time, one thing about money is what I learned is that 10 years is a long time. And somebody that might have money at one point, 10 years later, they may not have that money. And in fact, several of the investors told me that they made some bad investments and they lost all their money. And they were in tears when I paid them back and gave them 10% profit because they invested $10,000 here or whatever. And I paid them back and they were just flabbergasted, but they had lost all their money in a matter of 10 years. So it's actually 7 years because my contract was for 7 years. After 7 years, a Hollywood contract, or in this case, this contract is over. You don't have to do any more accounting after 7 years.
Wow. So you were the best investment that they had made in many cases.
No, I wasn't the best, but I did make them 10% and they were happy about it. Yeah.
That's great.
I don't know where you heard this story, but that's a good one. It's one of my, it's a lot raunchier than what I'm telling you. I cannot tell you the version on the air about really what happened, but you know, I gave you the Reader's Digest Hallmark watered down version. But I've got some stories that go along with this theme.
You know, it just reminds me of one of the moments from David Silverberg's film about you. Oh, my God, it's Herod Blank, where you say the pressure to conform is incredible, but I don't care what other people think. The reason I'm alive is to create.
Yep. That was a scene that I was wearing the Flash Cube suit.
Oh, the Flash suit. Yeah, you have the suit covered. This is like David Letterman before David Letterman. You have all the flash bulbs from cameras all over the jacket and trousers.
Right, right. And then the concept of that was to fool the audience to believe that all of the flash cubes were actually flashing. But in actuality, only 100 were flashing. And they were intermittently placed amongst the flash cubes that didn't flash on the suit. Similar to the camera van, the concept was that people would think, oh my God, all these cameras work, when in reality only 10 worked. And by the way, this woman just came down here to actually look at the camera van photography in the possibility of doing a book about the photography by the van, of the van, and the camera, the film that was found in the cameras, of which there's thousands of pictures of what people took pictures of in the 1950s through the 1980s.
Oh, before you bought the cameras at yard sales or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So the first thing I did when I put the cameras on the van was pull out the battery, which was heavy, and they had a lead weight, and then the film. And I put the film in a bucket. Well, I just kept that film for 10 years in buckets. And then one day I proposed to the Rocky Mountain Film Lab in Colorado, hey, wouldn't it be great to put out and you can be a lifetime sponsor? And he said, yes. So the Rocky Mountain Film Lab sponsored the processing of all these old antiquated film stocks, like before even 120. I mean, they're really weird film stocks.
I wanted to pivot back because you're talking about your dad, and Gina Lebrecht was a guest on Words and Pictures back in 2015. Gina and your dad had been collaborating on a profile of Richard Leacock, who helped pioneer the documentary style of direct cinema. Direct cinema was kind of the opposite, you know, I mean, that was that really fly on the wall kind of style that was the opposite of what your dad developed. But yeah, the film was called How to Smell a Rose, a visit to Ricky Leacock in Normandy. And yeah, your dad, tragically, he had cancer and he didn't see it finished. But we had a great screening here at the Hollywood Theater in Portland.
Yeah, I was actually executive producer on that and helped Gina get that done after Les's death. And it's a really good film. And in fact, I'm hoping that we'll have that on Criterion Channel next year. I'm working on it. Yeah. Ricky Leacock was somebody that Les admired. And it was sort of like the two men that lived a similar lifestyle. They're both filmmakers. They both loved food. They both loved the experience of life, and they really did it. They lived it. And I think that in a sense that the film about Ricky Leacock is also a film about Les Blank, similar to a lot of the films that Les makes. They have a glimpse into who he is too, because he obviously made the choices to make the movies. So there's a lot of Les, even in the Portrait of Lightning Hopkins, it's also a little bit of a portrait of Les.
Yeah, there's a couple of films about Lightning Hopkins that Les Blank made.
Yeah, there's The Sun's Gonna Shine and The Blues According to Lightning Hopkins, two films about Lightning Hopkins that Les made, with Skip Gerson, by the way.
Well, let's play a clip from the Les Blank film, I Went to the Dance.
You know, well, we come from crawfish, got soul there, man. Like,
growing up, you knew you were different. The French sound, it was something you always know you had, but we never considered it anything special because it was always put down.
What do you think changed it?
The folk festival changed. Dewey Belfour was the first one that started traveling to different festivals in the United States.
And instead of being an embarrassment, they received a standing ovation for playing what was called nothing but Chanky Chank alongside Joan Baez and Bob Dylan and Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Joe Peter Jaloux, Joe Peter de Fond.
The black Creole element was the element that was missing from Nova Scotia's why Cajun music doesn't sound like Acadian music.
I firmly believe that the accordion was picked up by French-speaking blacks first before it was played by Acadians.
What is this a demonstration of?
This is a demonstration about how these things are sturdy. They you know, put together. They're indestructible.
That's what tickled them Cajun under the toes. They can't stay still. They got to go dance. Yo!
That was a clip from the film I Went to the Dance, directed by Les Blank. You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And today we're talking with artist, author, and independent documentarian Herod Blank. Before we get back to the conversation, I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners that KBOO is in the midst of our Fresh Off the Vine membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our programming and that you'll take a moment to pledge your support. There are all kinds of ways to join KBOO. On the web, you can visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now let's talk some more with our guest, Herod Blank. Peter Bergman of the Firesign Theater, he organized the first ever Love-In back in 1967. It was Easter Sunday in Elysian Park, Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And your dad filmed the event. This was one of his first ever documentaries.
Yes, yes. God respects us when we work, but loves us when we play. That film is actually widely used in stock footage because it's such a sign of the times in 1967 when it was made. It was the hippie generation and very definitive. And I would say that that's something about Les that I don't know what it is, what you'd call it, a sixth sense or something, but he sure knew what was the sort of iconography of a place and time or a person. I mean, he really knew what to capture. So his footage of the Love-In was just iconographic, Lightning Hopkins, and even in Burning Man. At Burning Man, the stuff that he came back with that he shot on the Bell and Howell was amazing, amazing. And, you know, there's been a lot of films on Burning Man, but there's nobody like Les Blank that shot Burning Man. And now I hear that Netflix is doing a 5-part series on Burning Man, and they're working with a different filmmaker. And so that's a little disheartening because everybody knows I've been making this movie for 30 years.
This is important to say because obviously you and your dad were out there on the playa at Burning Man 30 some years ago with big, heavy film cameras. And nowadays anybody can go out and make a film with their phone, but yeah, they can't make a Les Blank film or a Herod Blank film with their phone. You know, you need not just that sensibility, but that lived experience and that eye and ear, the listening and the paying attention.
And what do you want to see? And what are you going to capture? I mean, the thing about Les is that, like I said, he had this sixth sense of what is iconic. You know, what should the camera be on? And the camera's always moving for Les. He doesn't put the camera on a tripod and film. He's moving the camera to make juxtapositions while he's filming. So with one eye, he's looking ahead, and one eye, he's looking at what he's shooting. And he's constantly trying to push the envelope and show what is there by moving the camera and seeing that place for what it is in time. The average person doesn't do that. And also, by the way, there is a difference when you're shooting film versus shooting digital. When you're shooting film, it costs a lot of money. You have to think before you turn the camera on, am what I'm filming worth it? Is what I'm going to put the camera on something that anybody else is going to want to see? And so you have to think about that, and how are you going to show it? And how are you going to move the camera, and what are you going to focus on? So there's a lot of variables that go into shooting film that really aren't there. The flip side of that is that when you go digital, you can just let the camera run and you can actually capture things digitally that you can't capture on film. And I was really looking at Burning Man from an anthropological alien point of view. I am a visitor from another planet filming these humans doing this. And I had a little bit of a distance on one hand. And Les was actually filming it similarly too, just experiencing what there was to experience. And when you don't have an agenda so much and you just let it happen, you get what just happens, more or less. And Les's footage is amazing.
Yeah, you touched on a lot. And I think it ties in really well with what you mentioned earlier about Werner Herzog. You know, Werner Herzog is this icon nowadays. He's in the Mandalorian, the Star Wars series, and everybody knows him. But, you know, when he started out, he was this German new wave filmmaker, the bad boy going into the jungle, and probably the most famous film that your dad made was the documentary Burden of Dreams, which was about the making of Fitzcarraldo, but not just about the making of Fitzcarraldo. Werner Herzog himself said that Les Blank created his own little universe in this film.
It's an amazing film on so many different levels. Les made his own universe, but it's really more about the indigenous people and their beauty and the beauty of the jungle. And then you have Werner, who's got a dream. So you have this strange paradox of making the dream at the risk of possibly destroying part of the nature. And there's this play on each other, and Les is there in the middle documenting both sides of this. And there's a lot of humanity in the movie. There's a lot of humanity behind Werner and his dream and what he's trying to accomplish. And then there's humanity of the indigenous people living their lives and dealing with each other's differences, you know, the tribal differences and things like that. There's a lot in that film. There's a lot of themes. And I think it's a huge movie.
All right, let's talk about your visit to Portland on Thanksgiving weekend. You'll be at two local cinemas screening your films as well as the works of fellow directors. And fingers crossed, there will be Art Cars in attendance. Automorphosis plays with the Greg Hamilton documentary Thou Shalt Not Tailgate Saturday, November 25th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. There will be a Q&A following the film with yourself and presumably Greg as well. On Sunday, November 26th, the Les Blank film, I Went to the Dance, from 1989, plays at 6 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Herod, you'll be talking about your dad after the film, and there will be Jambalaya, courtesy of Greg Hamilton. And finally, on Sunday, the 26th, at 9 p.m., the cult classic 1988 sci-fi horror film Killer Clowns from Outer Space plays at the Hollywood. That was actually directed by Stephen Kyoto, but Herod plays a number of murderous alien clowns in the film.
Yes. I think that if you were to watch all three of these films, J.T.O. Ball, Automorphosis, and Killer Clowns, if you went to all three screenings, you'd have a very strange weekend. By the way, I want to let you know that I will have headshots, stills from Killer Clowns that I will be autographing if anybody's interested after the screening of Killer Clowns. So keep that in mind. I mean, they'll be for sale, but they'll be available.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And my guest today has been award-winning independent filmmaker Herod Blank, director of the films Wild Wheels, Driving the Dream, and Automorphosis. Herod, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, and I'll see some of you at the theater.
Yeah, and for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your work, where would they look?
You could try artcarworld.org. You can come make an appointment to see the museum. You can make donations to the project if you like. It's a 501(c). And you could also try harrodblank.com or harrodblank on Facebook. And by the way, for Les Blank, it would be Les Blank Films on Facebook and Instagram. And the website for Les is lesblank.com. So if you go to lesblank.com or harrodblank.com or Art Car World, you will get a lot of information, and that's a good starting place.
Well, we hope that everybody has been enjoying our special programming for KBOO's Fall Membership Drive. Before we go, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that this community radio station needs your support. To become a member of KBOO or to arrange for a donation of any size, please visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. Or if you prefer, you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.
Darling, do you know something keeps on worrying me? Whoa, Lord, how am I? Yeah, something keeps on worrying me. Somewhere, but I'm about to wonder where can you be? And I broke down and I cried a little while. I said,